I have news about our hunt.
Quentin furrowed his thick brows.
Good news. Barely good news. And definitely not good news.
Tia had managed to pull her shit together somewhat, and hadn't asked Quentin for a hug the other day, despite having told him the outlines of how she'd killed Ravi and what she'd learned. She'd fled then to her solitude, only giving him the name Ativia Zalorn. She still wanted that hug, actually, but Quentin was so damned awkward, and he didn't like to be touched.
It would be selfish, and probably not satisfying, right?
Go ahead.
She'd asked to hear about his project first. It gave her time to gather her wits.
Easy one first. Zalorn is indeed a wine merchant. Very successful one, too. Well known among the nobility. High Lady Guile didn't have her people dig too deeply, though, lest it alarm anyone.
He described where to find Zalorn's house and his profile, physical description, style of clothing, 3 kids, 6 slaves, various servants between home and business, 2 long-term mistresses, and a pretty young wife who spent a lot of time crying about his many affairs, the pursuit of which seemed to be his main pastime.
Other than being a pagan priest, that was the shallow digging?
That's exactly how I reacted. High Lady Guile said, of course, anyone in the upper nobility would dig that much into anyone they were considering doing even casual business with.
Sometimes I think the nobles are just like the rest of us, and then other times, oh.
Also exactly my reaction.
That was the good news, though, wasn't it?
Though that was all helpful, she could have learned it herself. Though any time she went out in public was a time she was risking Sharp finding her.
Afraid so. Now, about the other project.
He opened a folio on his desk.
These are copies of all the final plans for each of the Chromeria's 7 towers. Builders' notes, allotments of slaves, materials requests, stockpiles and overages. Everything I could find. No budgets, irritatingly, which is what keyed me in. But I'm getting ahead of myself. If there's a hidden room in the Chromeria anywhere, it would show up here.
One of the jobs Tia had given Quentin was to search the Chromeria for the Old Man of the Desert's secret room. She knew he had one, if not more. She herself had lost caches of clothing and money and weapons simply to servants or strangers stumbling across them. There was no way the old man was going to risk the same happening to his codebooks. There was no way he'd risk someone interrupting him as he penned or decoded his secret messages. Secrecy required privacy, and the bigger the secret, the more privacy required.
That sounds pretty good. Can you not read them? Are they in code or something?
No, I can read them. Now, I had to study up on construction techniques and terminology. Took me a while.
So, the bad news is...
The plans show no space for any hidden rooms at all. Everything is clear and public.
Okay.
But I found an exterminator's report of a rat's nest right here under the young disciples' barracks.
Tia looked at the plans, but for her, they might as well have been written in Old Tyrian.
Explain.
See? In the diagram here, there's no space at all. This is supposed to be hardwood planking directly over stone. But the rat catcher's report mentions finding a rat king. Oh, do you know what that is?
No.
You don't want to. Regardless, he said the rat king was 2 paces high. According to the plans, that's impossible. There's no space for it. So the plans are wrong. So I went outside, and using some trigonometry and an astrolabe, I was able to calculate the heights of the towers.
And the prism's tower was taller than these plans say?
No. All of the towers are taller than the plans say. 4 paces taller. And these are the most recent plans. So that means there isn't just one secret room. There's the equivalent of 1 secret floor in every tower.
How do you hide an entire secret floor?
Cleverly, I guess. Maybe not all in one place. People look at the towers from the outside all the time and point out their rooms and the rooms of their friends. I don't even know how you do it, honestly. I'm no master builder, but whoever did this certainly was. Of course, I am pretty sure that they must have had the true plans somewhere. For the inevitable repairs, or to keep later workmen and servants away from them, if nothing else. So, I guess the Black would have those. Or the Promacos.
My money's on Andros Guile. The man's a maelstrom of secrets.
I concur.
Quen, no one says I concur.
I know, but it bothers you.
Tia forced a smile, but then returned to the task.
It's not like we can ask Carver Black.
Should I break into his rooms? His office? How long would it take me to find a book he's hidden? Can I spare the time from hunting the Order itself to surveil him? What reason would Carver Black have to check the old tower plans? He might have those documents, not ever check them. And who's to say Carver Black even knows? Does the old man of the desert hide in a place Carver Black knows? Is Carver Black himself in the Order? Oh.
It all made her head hurt. She would need years to untangle all this fully.
And it's not like I can kill Carver Black without anyone noticing. No, my best bet isn't to go after individuals to find if they're in the Order. It's to let the Order come to me.
She rubbed her jaw gingerly.
I have to figure out some way to mark every person who attends the Feast of the Dying Light the night before Sunday. Maybe in the changing room? Can I mark their clothing? Then Kerris's soldiers can sweep down on the traitors on Sunday morning and wipe them out in one fell swoop. We can celebrate Sunday by putting the old man of the desert up on a Hollum's glare.
There was one man Tia would happily watch cook, screaming in agony as he died.
If I can survive that long.
She rubbed her jaw again.
Oh, tooth still hurting? I thought you were going to see the White's barber about that before all this even started.
I did. Not that I can tell. But he said it's better now than it would have been if I hadn't come to see him.
A non-falsifiable statement. Clever.
I'm supposed to chew some herbs to help, but I always forget. I don't know what irritates me more, that he might be a charlatan or that this may be my fault because I don't follow instructions.
She heard the whinging in her voice and shut up. Quentin looked at her and didn't fill the sudden silence.
It's killing me.
Your tooth? Not your tooth.
She sat on Quentin's bed.
Quentin, you're on a first name basis with the guy. How can Oholam allow this?
This?
I'm a butcher, Quinn. I've taken to scoring a notch on my knife for each kill.
He said nothing, but he wasn't fast enough to hide the brief flash of distaste on his lips.
Not to brag about the number, to remind myself, because I was forgetting. They all run together until I dream. Oh, the way that one slave gurgled on his blood because he bit his tongue so hard in his fear of me before I even touched him. How that other girl wept from the moment the door opened and never even got a word out because she was crying so hard. I remember how I despised her, how I wished she would die as bravely as some of the others had. Do you know they gave me a break? The Order. Said that too many slaves had disappeared and they needed to hold off until some more refugees came to the island so no one would get suspicious. And I felt disappointed because it would interrupt my studies. Disappointed. For only a moment, yes, but what the hell is that? I don't want to be this person I'm becoming, Quentin. Why would Oholam allow this?
If Oholam can do something, and if he cares about us, why doesn't he?
Right. So what's the answer?
The answer's simple for the mind, but impossible for the heart. And the question, honestly asks, always comes from a wound.
He said no more. She waited, then understood.
So you're not going to tell me?
Not when you're hurting and angry. You'll reject the answer. And then later, you'll think of it as an answer you already found lacking. And perhaps you'll neglect to consider it again. Having found a door's handle bristling with needles, you'll tell yourself it's probably locked anyway. When you come to the big questions, before you can get a true answer, you need to know whether you're approaching them rationally or emotionally.
A blackguard guards his emotions. So you're not going to tell me the rational answer until I can approach the question rationally.
It's not that it's a big magisterium secret. You could go ask any Luxiat and get the same answer today that I'll give you when you're ready. Though some will phrase it more or less eloquently, but in my estimation, you'll profit more from it later. If you disagree, you're free to ask them.
You're asking me to trust you when I don't understand something hard for me. That's supposed to parallel something, isn't it?
I didn't mean it to, but perhaps it does. Thanks for thinking I'm smarter than I am.
She pursed her lips to keep from smiling, though the hollow in her chest still ached.
Now, you were abrupt last time. Seemed on edge. You killed this slaver, Ravi Satish. Easy kill?
Sticking a hammer in his head? Easier than I thought. Fooling him, pathetically easy. The rest won't trouble my sleep.
And you're going out to hunt your old mistress presently. You're going to kill her?
She nodded once, sharp as a falling guillotine.
This is your first job that isn't purely professional.
It's necessary. If she contacts Murder Sharp, it brings him to her, and that puts him way too close to me. Plus, she intends to contract a hit on a Guile. Not Andros, I'm sure. Sharp probably wouldn't take the job. But how could I explain that to Karis?
Those are all good reasons. Sufficient reasons.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Tia felt stricken. He knew she wasn't being honest, and yet his eyes were filled with compassion.
She's low-level, Quinn. I mean, she's a noble, so she'd rise quickly in their ranks. But she told Ravi she only joined them to try and get revenge on the Guiles for something. Which, come to think of it, she ranted to me about a long time ago. Her brother was the governor of Garriston, and Gavin Guile killed him as a traitor, something, I don't know exactly. But it means she's not a true believer. And I know where the Order's meeting now. She doesn't need to die, not exactly. I mean, she's committed capital offenses and she's covered under my writ. But if she were anyone else and she got away, it wouldn't trouble me. She wouldn't be forming a new order 10 years from now. But I want to kill her almost as much as I want the old man.
Then you know?
I know what?
Quentin looked at her, and his eyes were old and gentle.
Tia, this is the most dangerous job you've ever done. Not physically. This is where you can come to love what you do. The power of it. The righteous vengeance. This work wounds you. But this job is where you can get dirt in the wound.
God, like I haven't already.
To this point, you've been a shield. Doing what you have to do. Getting battered and torn, protecting those you love. Now you decide what else you are. You can torture her if you want. You can try to make her pay for all she did to your friends and to you. You can look into her eyes and wring whatever suffering from her you desire. No one can stop you.
And no one should.
Some Luxiats say even the 200 may yet repent. But from what you've told me of her, I dare say Aglaia's damnation is assured. What's in question is yours.
Gavin sat down on a pedestal, the great, cumbersome luststone he'd borne for the entire circuit around the Black Tower. Above the pedestal was a statue, and beyond the statue, another locked gate. This statue was of a kneeling man with face upturned, radiant, lambent in his white marble against all the sea of black stone here. All the statues had been the same white. The weight of the stone released a boonstone whiter than his hand from the statue's grip. Gavin picked up the boonstone.
Chastity, I suppose.
The prophet didn't have to answer.
I'll be happy to give this one up to Orholam.
The old man was as stone-faced as the statues, and a good deal less joyful.
You know, to hand over chastity. Because I don't want it?
Orholam pursed his lips.
Not like, give up my chastity to Orholam like a sexual... You know what? Never mind. Just looking for a little levity after the bludgeoning I just took with that round. You know what I mean?
No.
So, tell me, why aren't you pilgriming with me? Pilgriming. Pilgrimaging? Still sounds right. I'm the head of the faith, and I don't know how people usually say it. I think I like pilgriming. Feels grim, and it's a bitter pill, right? No? Not working with me at all here, are you? Fine. Why aren't you pilgriming? No sins to purge? Too holy already?
Gavin took the chastity boonstone and tucked it into a pocket in the pilgrim's tunic. It was heavy, but it fit perfectly. When Grinwoody had commissioned Gavin for this task, he'd mentioned magical locks at every level that the fleeing guardians had left to keep out drafters of each associated color. That was why Gavin, unable now to draft, was supposedly the perfect candidate to assassinate Orholam, or the magical nexus called Orholam. So far, though, Gavin had only felt a whisper of resistance as he walked through each gate, and that may have been his imagination or his dread at what the next circle would hold. They moved farther into the landing. There was one between each circle. Here, silently, they ate saltfish and drank water while Gavin recovered. The steep chute that Gavin had seen below had an opening here.
I wonder how many pilgrims fail not on each level but on the spaces between them like this, where they ponder how terrible the next one will be. How easy is it to give up and simply escape, too afraid to confront what lays next?
I'm journeying for you. If I did my own pilgrimage, I would take much less time on certain circles than you, leaving you alone. It's even possible I might take more time on certain circles, dimly. Wrath, for one, would not be easy on me. But I'm here to walk with you step for step, no matter how long you take. We're not meant to take the pilgrimage alone.
So no pilgrimage for you at all?
When my business with you is finished, I'll go back down and start my own climb.
I'm really delighted that you are here for me, but I won't be joining you for yours. You know that, right?
Yeah, I know. Oh, there's my old wrath again rearing up inside.
I piss you off that much, huh? And here I've been being as respectful as I can manage. Wrath is going to be a tough circle for me, too.
This is your chance to decide whether you want to be that old deceiver, Gavin Guile, or if you want to be a Dazen Guile made new. I know you want that. You've made attempts before. This is an opportunity to change, Guile, and you've been offered more of those than most get. Take it.
The old prophet hunkered down with his own saltfish, turning his back on Gavin.
Well, the conversation clearly is finished. Some company for my pilgrimage.
Gavin had mostly given up trying to understand the magic of whoever had created this tower.
It has to be a highly advanced will-casting focused magic, from the way it's triggering my memories.
It had multiple flashbacks during every circle.
Makers of this thing have weaponized my own mind against me. This isn't a hike up a tower. It's a trek through everything I've ever done wrong. Everything I've never done right. This is my every failure held up to the light and splintered into its component deadly sins through a black prism.
It was not a magic to be understood, merely one to be endured. He was gaining no new knowledge of magic, but only of himself. How the tower's Tyrian makers, if this wasn't older than even their empire, had understood vice and virtue, was different than what the Chromeria taught. Gavin had learned, and as the highest Luxiad even taught the seven virtues as being the four worldly virtues, prudence, courage, justice, temperance, and the three heavenly ones, charity, hope, and faith. Believers were to meditate on these virtues and how they might embody them better, as they made the sign of the four and the three, touching hand, heart, and lips. If you counted hands as a collective singular, you would count them as number three, whereas if you counted each hand in turn separately, they would count as three and four, thus symbolizing a paradox and the connection of all the virtues, or all the vices, to one another. Here, though ultimately the lists basically covered the same territory as the Chromeria's, the tower's builders had divided up the pilgrimage into seven contrary virtues: patience against wrath, abstinence against gluttony, liberality against greed, diligence against sloth, chastity against lust, kindness against envy, and humility against pride. Gavin hadn't thought that lust was going to be a difficult circle for him.
After all, I've been unwillingly chaste for quite a while now. Sure, I'm as virile as the next two guys, but I haven't been promiscuous. Especially for a prism, with all the opportunities I've had.
But the memories he'd triggered at every step had focused not on numbers of women he'd taken to his bed, but mostly on how he'd treated Marissia, not only in bed, but out of it. He'd prided himself on treating Marissia very, very well for a room slave. That she hadn't been a slave at all, but was only masquerading as one, was, if anything, a reason for him to be angry with her. The tower hadn't let him off so easily.
It didn't care whether she was slave or free. It triggered my memories of how I treated her.
They weren't flattering. Marissia had been, in Gavin's careless estimation, supposed to feel only gratitude or desire toward him. That was pretty much the entire range of emotions he'd expected from her, and it was all he'd allowed her to express. He'd seen undeniably over the years that the true range was far, far greater. He'd seen her despair. He'd seen her love for him, and her self-loathing at times, seemingly because she did love him. But he'd written them all off, as if they and she weren't worthy of his attention.
It must have been torture for her.
Gavin would treat her well, showering her with compliments, thanking her for how well she was running his household and managing the servants and slaves. Some days he would ask her opinion on matters of all kinds, confide in her, give her gifts, and take her to his bed and make sure she reached her pleasure rather than merely take his own. Other days he would demand she serve him sexually at a moment's notice, pretending instant arousal and total desire, though her dryness betrayed the pretense he'd ignored it or blamed her for it. Then he'd banished her from the room, as if she were no more than a rag to mop up his semen. That's what room slaves are for, he told his protesting conscience. I treat her well.
And she'd endured it, while knowing she could end her torture at any moment by revealing she wasn't a slave at all. But she believed in her mission too much to do that. Or she loved me so much that she stayed despite it all. Or did the abuse so wear her down that she contented herself with taking the emotional scraps that fell from my table, and slowly come to believe it was all she deserved? How long can everyone around you tell you that you're a slave? How long can every mirror show you to be a slave, and you not believe you really are one? I destroyed a great woman. I took the best years of her life and told myself I was doing right by her.
And he'd known better.
Fuck me. Fuck this climb.
He rubbed his face, inadvertently brushing the eye patch. It didn't hurt anymore. Now, if anything, that shock of sensation it sent through his whole body was pleasantly numbing. After climbing the circles of pride and envy and lust so far, the picture of himself that was emerging was as devastating as it was undeniable. But if this journey was supposed to be purgative, Gavin didn't see how.
Purgatives are supposed to make you puke, but then feel better. I don't feel better, nor any more humble, kind, or chaste. Only more aware of how much I'm not those things.
Rubbing the eye patch deeper into his eye, oily pain canceling out sharp pain for a brief moment, he stood up and walked to the edge overlooking the sea.
What the? Gunner's gone!
Yeah.
Gunner had been drinking out there.
Must have gotten drunk and fallen off. There's no way he would have abandoned his big gun to the waters. No way he would have tried to swim when there were still so many sharks gathered from leagues around to feed on all the bodies floating in the lagoon.
When sober, Gunner was a master of timing. If he'd decided he was going to have to abandon the gun and swim, he would have waited until everything calmed in the lagoon. A few days at the least, while the sharks sated their hunger, devouring all the bloating dead.
You told him he was going to live.
I know.
God damn.
And Gavin had been starting to believe that Orholm wasn't a holy-talking charlatan. That, wherever it came from, he really did see the future sometimes, and the past. Gavin turned and walked back, brushing past the old man.
What circles next?
Wrath!
Perfect.
How many fights do we have left in us, Cruxer?
It seemed like a good time to ask. Tysus was on the other side of their little fleet, checking on her reserve scouts, and she didn't like him dwelling on the depth awaiting them. The early morning embarkation had been somber. Now they were crossing the Cerulean Sea at the maximally efficient skimmer speed. Slow compared to what the craft were capable of, at preserving the lives of their drafters while still getting them to the Chromeria in 2 days. Every one of the 1,000 drafters, 200 Kowinawar willcasters and war dogs, and 1,000 elite soldiers knew they were heading for a fight for their own lives, for the future of the Empire, and even for the future worship of Orholm himself. Would the 7 satrapies even exist, or would there be instead 9 kingdoms with a high king? Would there be 10 gods in this world, or one?
Well, mentally, we are tough.
The sea was placid, the sun orange on the horizon, and the sky crystal and blue. It was one of those pristine summer mornings that made you feel that Orholam was full of joy when he created the world.
Emotionally, you all feel like we can fight forever.
That wasn't what Kippet meant, and they both knew it. He glanced back at the phalanxes of skimmers and sea chariots behind them. With rafters of various colors of Luxon paired at the reeds of the different ships, their colors mixing as they jetted it into the water, the thousands of the forest's best were painting Ceres' skin like artists, each wielding a different tone, human colors rising in answer to the divine in the skies.
2 or 3 hot skirmishes, maybe. 1 protracted battle, and after that, we'll start losing significant numbers to Luxon burnout. Too many of them have been making up for their lack of skill by drafting ever greater quantities. We might even lose a few on the passage.
And the mighty?
Kip already had his own guesses, of course, but he was trying to be dispassionate. A full year of raiding and the Battle of Dunvia had meant many fights to the death. And when your life is in peril today, why be careful with how much you draft so you can live another year 15 years from now?
The Nunks are fine, of course. Bakuti isn't too bad with blue, but his green is to the halos. Winston will live forever. His yellow is barely halfway through his irises. Titus is fine with her green. I've got 4 or 5 battles left in me. Ben-Hadad is fine with yellow, but whenever he's near a fight, he tries too hard to compensate for his bad leg. His green and blue are both full. It is Big Leo who will probably go first. He is straining his halos in both red and sub-red.
We're insane for letting Ben-Hadad even get close to a battle. He's great in a fight, but ultimately he's just another drafter. But outside a fight, doing what he does? The man's a marvel. A once-in-a-generation genius. He's the one of us who could change the world the most.
Well, you've pretty much summed up my thoughts exactly.
Glad we're agreed about—
About you.
Oh!
Granted, you are a bit better in a fight, maybe, having 2 good legs and all.
The hint of a smile crept onto Cruxer's face. He couldn't deadpan quite like Iron Fist. Not yet.
The trouble is, a man isn't just the one thing he does best. Even if he's the best at that one thing the world has ever seen.
Cruxer turned his palms up.
I haven't tried to keep you from fights, have I?
No.
But lay off screen, huh? Now you go Golem 1 more time. You may break the halo yourself.
Yeah, I've got other options.
I know you do. Use them. It's always green with you.
Yes, Mother.
But they both knew Cruxer was right. The Mighty didn't want to fight on the seas, but Ben had refused to let them go unarmed in case a fight was necessary. Maybe the White King had discovered how to make skimmers by now. Also, they'd heard wild rumors about Willcast sharks and other beasts. Kip's nightmares didn't think it could be done, though. Or not for long. Or not without them also attacking one's own people, or... So the Nightbringers had muskets, a few swivel guns, and a pile of the sticky bombs they called hole-wreckers now. The skimmers wouldn't be defenseless, but they wouldn't go looking for a slugfest with a galleon, either. A single cannonball strike anywhere would cause a catastrophic failure of the Luxon. Ben-Hadad said he already had plans to address that in the next generation of skimmers, if he lived so long. Cruxer had one of General Derwin's drafters taking point 100 paces out in front of them. A nautical equivalent of outriders protected him on either flank, but the main body traveled in cohorts of 20 craft each, with everything from 2 to 6-person craft. Kip was trying to be patient, though he wanted to get to the Crimeria today, and could have, moving with only the mighty. Moving even a small army at speed was an impressive feat of logistical acumen and leadership. Moving that army over water made it a feat, wherein if you loused up, people drowned. Kip supposed that he should be trying to enjoy the little remaining life he had. It was pretty much impossible to get any work done. Despite the wind blocker, he had to lean close to Cruxer to have a conversation, and it was just Cruxer, Kip, and 2 young drafters with fresh halos on reeds. Kip had tried talking to them, but that had put a panicked expression in their eyes. They couldn't concentrate on 2 things at once.
Lord Commander!
The reed labored to speak and still keep in time with their partner.
Scout returning!
Kip saw the scout streaking toward them on a type of craft they'd come to call a flying pulpit. The scout's special skimmers were made to be as light and fast as possible, so they'd dispensed with nearly everything. It consisted of a single chair mounted between two propulsion reeds with wings extending from the sides beneath the water. Each scout drafter, all were small men with excellent upper body strength, was strapped to his chair and carried a long lens to see even farther. The craft were ludicrously fast, but they had to be launched at speed and couldn't stop moving or they'd sink. The 10th scout was Isam Rassen, who was approaching now. 40 years old, he was a gotra-wearing Parian who'd been training to be a blackguard when he fell during a wall climb and broke his back. His legs had turned useless and numb. A couple of unnoticed sores on them had gotten infected, and they'd had to be amputated. He'd lived through the operation, but his Cremeria sponsor had abandoned him illegally, despite his strength as a green drafter. Isam Rassen hadn't had the coin or connections to bring the matter before a magistrate, and he ended up performing on the streets for food, doing acrobatics for coins. How he'd even made the trek through Blood Forest in the hopes that Kip's army would have some place for him, Kip didn't know. The man was bursting with life and purpose now. Kip had never seen anyone more proud to don the uniform. The scout turned in behind Kip's skimmer and docked in a slot made especially for it. Kip and Kruxer attached the hooks that bound the small skimmer to their larger one while he took a few deep breaths. As Amrassen's massive shoulders shone with sweat, he'd come back at the greatest possible speed.
Two fleets, my lord, closing for battle, as far as I can tell. Definitely the blood robes on one side and the Cromeria on the other. Maybe 150 galleons on the blood robe side, but a lot of those seem to be trade ships with only a few cannons each. Cromeria's only got 53 galleons, but they're well armed. They're flying banners of all seven satrapies.
How far from here?
3 leagues? 4? I could be off.
The scouts had trained to measure distances by their own speed over time, which they were supposed to keep constant. But Isam Rassen had come back as quickly as possible.
And how far from each other?
A bit more than a league. I guess the fight will start within half an hour? An hour? I don't know anything about naval battles, my lord. My apologies. I'm still learning my work.
As are we all.
There was something strange, though. I don't know anything about naval warfare firsthand, but I have seen tapestries and paintings and such. And the Cromeria's ships were out in big wings, left and right, with multiple ranks and such, like the paintings. But the left wing was leading a lot. Too much, it seemed to me, unless there's some strategy.
Who's on the left wing?
They were too far away for me to pick out their banners for sure. But given the style of the ships and the colors, Hrothgar, and...
He scrunched his eyes closed, trying to remember.
Snake below it?
Coiled or striking?
Striking.
Commander, please tell me that moron Carl Asmuth isn't in charge of Hrothgar's fleet.
Last we heard, he'd been demoted because of his disastrous leadership at Oxford.
Asmuth had been commander of the armies, but his family was rich and powerful. Kip knew how those families worked now.
I bet they bought his way onto a small command with the fleet, where they thought he couldn't do any harm.
Or Holum's balls! He broke ranks! He's charging, hoping to reclaim his lost glory!
Kruxer, brow darkening, made the sign of the 3 and the 4.
May Aholum save those men from their leader!
But that wasn't all! The White King's ships were all huddled together, real tight, almost in a ball. Not at all like any tapestry I've seen. I know artists exaggerate and try to make things look pretty, but isn't being encircled as bad in naval battles as it is in land ones?
Messengers on small skimmers pulled in beside Kip's craft, waiting for orders to relay.
No bane visible?
No, sir. Didn't even feel anything. And I was paying attention like you said to.
Ah, shit. They're doing the same damned thing they did at Rue. Sinking a bane so the drafters don't feel it, raising it at the last moment. Except this time it isn't one color, it's all of them. What kind of idiot falls into the same trap they've used on us before?
Carl Asmuth.
We have to warn them.
We are all drafters.
We're the only ones who can get to them in time.
We can't go.
They'll all die if we don't.
Breaker, when a man who can't swim jumps into the sea to save a drowning friend, you end up with two dead men, not zero.
Kip turned to the messengers.
I've new orders. Redistribute the supply ships. Take the empties to circle behind the White King's fleet after the battle and pick up survivors from the waves. Don't come in too fast or too close, or they'll be sunk too. But save as many as they can. I don't think the White King will double back. Izam Rassen, you go get rest. You're gonna be light sick as it is. You two on the reeds, go with the messengers. Commander Cruxer and I have it from here.
The young drafters stepped off the still-moving skimmer onto messengers' vessels. Kip turned to another messenger.
Tell our fleet to continue on. We'll catch up by nightfall.
Nightfall?
Or, you know, not at all.
Tysis is going to be pissed.
She was off checking on something on the other side of the fleet.
Yep.
Because this is a bad idea.
I know.
Cruxer made the sign of the seven again, and then took a reed.
You know, Blackguard training has very specific rules about keeping one's ward from putting himself in mortal peril unnecessarily.
He looked at Kip's open, expectant face.
So, I guess it is a good thing we quit before we got to that part.
Turning people into meat sacks was the easy part. The problem was disposing of the bodies. For all that Tia now knew dozens of ways to kill, she wasn't superhuman. Even in her blacks, holding a spear and soaking wet, she weighed less than 2 sevs. She'd done tens of thousands of push-ups and curl-ups. She'd run thousands of leagues. She'd swum until her shoulders were small blocks of granite. She'd lifted salt bags until veins bulged from her forearms even at rest. And she'd run relays with the Blackguard trainees until she could run down a gazelle on the open plains. She could climb and jump and balance and fight and shoot a bow and fire a musket and draft.
Dear Aholem, I even dance tolerably well now.
But when it came to lifting a corpse that was more than double her weight, she was hopeless. The good news was that she wouldn't need to drag Aglaia's body far. In quick glances, Tia watched the noblewoman have her cosmetics supplied by a severe old slave woman who was, despite her age and her own plain features, obviously an artist. It was evening, but Aglaia had come fresh-faced from a steam bath at an unmarked private club in the embassy's district. The old slave applied delicate layers of powders and creams with a sure and speedy hand. Tia used the time to scout the estate again. It was a meeting night for the Order of the Broken Eye. That meant Aglaia had taken dinner in her room, as she apparently always did on the nights when she attended the Order's meetings, and she'd dismissed the slaves except for this handmaid. Of course, what a woman like Aglaia thought dismissing the slaves meant, and what it really meant, were very different. She would be angry if she came home and her dishes and food weren't cleared from her room and her bed wasn't turned down, a warming plate put between the sheets to prepare them for her. As if these things happened by magic. As if she were giving her slaves a break, rather than complicating their lives. For them, the dismissal meant,
get all the usual work done without me seeing you, and pretend not to see me leave, and never ask about where I'm going or where I've been, and there will be extra laundry in the morning.
At long last, the slave finished her duties. As far as Tia could tell, the slave woman had done magic of a sort Gavin Guile himself would envy.
Old horseface actually looks attractive.
Tia had no idea why Aglaia was putting on cosmetics, though. The woman would be donning a cloak and mask, which were required to stay on for the rest of the night.
Well, she thinks so, anyway.
Aglaia looked at herself in her mirrors. She seemed dissatisfied with what she saw.
You are dismissed, Clotildus.
Tia waited with the patience of a coiled serpent. Aglaia moved to a closet. She pulled a hatbox off the highest shelf she could reach. She carried the box to a bed, but didn't open it. Tia crept forward invisibly on her rubber sap-soled shoes, moving behind her prey. Aglaia turned so abruptly, she almost collided with Tia. Tia shrank back, eyes downcast. Aglaia moved forward quickly, but then stopped just as Tia was preparing to lash out with peril. Aglaia sat, grabbed a hair tie, and scowling at her reflection, rapidly bound up her long blonde hair into a sensible bun.
It's time.
Tia touched her chest where the vial of olive oil had once rested. It had been Aglaia's threat of sending her to be a brothel slave at the mines. The blade came from its leather sheath, noiselessly. Aglaia stared intently at her reflection.
You are not afraid, Aglaia Indomita Crassus. You think of Marcus. You think of what the Giles did to him, and you make them pay.
It should have stirred something in Tia. Some human emotion. If not an emotion, a question at least. Peril was supposed to make you more susceptible to feeling. But even handling peril didn't do more than make Tia aware of the spot that was numb, like tapping frostbitten fingers against a stranger's flesh.
This is no time for thoughts or second thoughts. This isn't payback. I am merely predator, you are merely prey. No torture, no final words.
Tia squeezed the nerves in each of Aglaia's shoulders and watched her arms fall unfeeling to her sides. As the woman looked down, wondering why her arms had dropped, Tia grabbed that sensible bun with one hand and rammed the dagger into the back of Aglaia's neck. With peril illuminating the gap between skull and spine, Tia's blade slid in as easily as if Aglaia had lubed herself up for the unwanted penetration with olive oil and penetrated to the hilt. Aglaia's body went limp instantly, but Tia held her in place by her hair, that beautiful blonde hair that provided such a nice grip and guided her back into her seat. Tia wrenched the blade back and forth to ensure she'd fully severed the spine, then left it in Aglaia's neck as she grabbed a rag from a pocket. She barely got the rag in place around the blade to blot up the blood before it leaked onto the fine chair's back. Tia rolled Aglaia out of the chair and onto the bare floor, face down, dagger up. Then Tia left her prey and locked the door. When she came back, she waited a few more heartbeats and then used peril to feel for life. You could punch a hole in a man's heart and he might yet move as you made a full count to 10. The body could be stubborn. It was faster with the spine, but it never hurt to be sure.
Dead. Easy.
A bit of blood and spinal fluid seeped out around the dagger's blade and into the rag, but with the wound elevated and the heart stopped, there was no more bleeding than that. Tia had picked a short dagger deliberately so it wouldn't pierce all the way through the woman's neck. By design, but also by luck, she'd severed the spine without also slicing the big arteries in the neck. The dead woman had pissed herself, but only a little, and her petticoats had held most of it. A few dribbles had escaped onto the wood floor, and none onto the upholstered seat of the chair.
Excellent.
Lest it get stained, Tia removed the master cloak and got to work. She untied the two bags she'd tied tight around her waist. The first held half a sieve of rocks. The second was larger and made of waxed canvas. Unhurried, Tia laid out that bag next to Aglaia's body and opened it. Then, carefully, she put the body onto the bag, lifting and moving feet, then knees, then hips, shoulders, and arms, keeping the dead woman's face down and wound up always. She buttoned the buttons as she was able. Then she left off buttoning the bag and cleaned the floor fastidiously. Last, she slid the dagger out of Aglaia's spine and cleaned the blade, and tucked the rag into the bag as well.
Now it gets dicey.
She tested dragging the body, being careful to keep the wound elevated.
Easy, on stone.
Tia's disposal site was a latrine at the end of a long hallway. A long hallway with one of those runner carpets that's easier to kick out of the way than to keep in place. And Tia was going to be dragging a body down that.
Damn it. There's no way I can add the weight of all these rocks and do this. I'm going to have to drag the body down the hall, then come back, get the rocks, take them down the hall, open the bag, put the rocks in, then lever the body somehow into the latrine. If you get caught, can you kill the servant who sees you, Tia? How about a slave? Yes. Why do I keep revisiting the choice? In this war, if innocents have to die, innocents have to die.
She saw their faces again.
More innocents.
She pulled Aglaia's body out into the hall, then rolled it until she got to the edge of the carpet runner. No blood seeped out, though on this patterned red carpet, it wouldn't have been disastrous. Hugging the corpse against herself to be able to pull it down the hall without leaking blood was somehow less repulsive to Tia than it would have been to hug Aglaia in life.
Meat. This is simply meat.
The vile part of it had departed. Her spirit had been a putrescence worse than the merely physical odors of urine and decay. Tia made it to the latrines.
There. No problems. No blood. All clean. Professional.
Tia jogged back and grabbed her rocks. When she made it back, she put the rocks into the waxed bag with the body and closed it again. The latrine opening wasn't overly wide, but mercifully, Lady Crassus had been a big believer in girdles, and the bag was cinched tight.
One last thing, lady.
She drew the short dagger again and stabbed it low in the corpse's stomach to pierce the intestines. Gases were released as she withdrew the knife. At least those were smells not out of place in a latrine. She pierced the bag in several other places. The stones at Aglaia's feet would pull those lowest, so Tia made the holes near the corpse's head. Then she began stuffing the body down the latrine, bit by bit. Each grunt and heave a labor pang, Tia squeezed Aglaia's body through the death canal and out of this life.
Shit you were, my lady, and to shit you return.
But the body only dropped a few feet. The rocks inside hit metal. Tia froze for a moment, then remembered. This mansion's indoor latrines had a metal plate below that swung open to drop waste and then swung closed again to keep the odors below from being blown constantly back up into the house. Tia found the handle and with effort, because of the weight of the body on the plate, was able to slide it aside. Lady Aglaia slid like an especially large turd into the effluvia below. Tia slid the plate closed. Then she went invisible and walked into the hall, where she waited. With every corpse she left, Tia was inviting the Order to suspect her existence, so every kill had to account for the body somehow. Here, Tia had already scouted the mansion for disposal areas, going as far as directing peril gas between the walls and eventually down the latrines. Here there was a holding area for the sewage, a septic pit. Tia hadn't known anything about sewage. But with what she'd learned from Quentin, she'd made her bag. Enough murdered bodies was to shore every week on the Jaspers that Tia knew they bloated with gases and floated to the surface, white, ghastly things. So she needed the rocks to keep Aglaia's body down. She'd pierced the stomach to allow the release of accumulating gases and pierced the bag to make sure it didn't inflate and buoy the body to the surface. Their hope, they hadn't done this before, was that the body would decay naturally in the sewage, but that the bag would slow the rate of decay. They didn't want the body to bob to the surface, where it had a chance of being seen. They also didn't want it to decay so quickly that anyone using the latrine would smell death. Instead, they hoped, the air that blew through the sewage ducting would have a chance to take the smell of decay a little bit at a time. Tia almost left before she remembered the hatbox. As she slipped back into Lady Aglaia's chambers, she saw a slave on her way back up the steps to clean out the room. Tia grabbed the hatbox with its order mask and robes and walked to the closet.
Damn me.
Aglaia had gotten the box down from the highest shelf she could reach. Unfortunately, Aglaia had been significantly taller than Tia was. The shelf was too high for Tia. Tia hopped and tried to shove the box into its spot. Not even close to high enough.
Oh, for Ohulam's sake, a stupid hatbox.
But any wrong detail could give her away, even stupid ones.
I have to be a ghost, and ghosts don't leave evidence.
She looked at the door.
You only have one shot at this, T. If you miss, it's going to be a disaster.
The closet was a mess. Hatboxes were piled upon each other in huge piles. Even putting one on top of the pile with too much force might make the whole collection collapse. Tia backed up and took a running leap and stabbed the costume box toward its spot with a little toss at the end. She landed on her toes in the closet, a hair's breadth away from colliding with the entire stack. She tipped forward.
No!
She couldn't see anything to balance herself against that wouldn't knock down everything. But just as the door opened, she regained her balance and threw the master cloak closed about her. But she stepped on the hem of the cloak as she stepped backward and fell.
No, no!
Gracefully. She spun, taking the fall on her hip and tucking her knees so the cloak spun around her, covering them. A servant walked in. She saw Aglaia's half-full tray of food. She sat and ate. She didn't even look around. Tia steadied herself and regained her grip of peril. While the girl was distracted, Tia stood. Then she got her first look at the hatbox. She had left the closet door open, of course, and the hatbox was perched at the top of its tower, precariously. The air billowing gently into the room from the open door was enough to set the whole stack swaying.
No, no, no!
If Tia jumped and missed, it would all come down, and her cloak would be swirling around chaotically at the very moment the servant girl looked toward the sound.
Please don't make me have to kill a pimply 16-year-old kitchen girl.
The girl finished eating in no time and stood. She glanced toward the closet and walked over.
Oh, Holum, damn it, what did she see?
But the girl stood on tiptoe and pushed the hatbox back into place and closed the closet. Then she grabbed the tray and left without a look back. Now all Tia had to do was go out on the balcony, climb quickly down to the street, and be on her way to the Order's meeting to find the priest. Then Tia realized that with this kill, she didn't feel damned. She didn't feel disgusted. She didn't feel satisfied.
I don't feel anything at all.